We very much appreciate being able to get together with you. Some of you have had to select the times that you can come, but we're very glad. It's like when you get on an airplane, they say, we know you have a choice when you travel, and thank you for choosing our airline. We know you have lots of options how to spend your Friday evening, and we very much appreciate you spending it with us. And Elena, we're glad you could stop by. Nice to see you. Out the door already. Well, this is one time I don't want you to follow her example. I'm mindful of the fact that this is Veterans Day, and I'd like to just take special note of the veterans that we have among us. Many have passed on through the years, but we still have some veterans today with us that are advancing in age now, and we just want to thank you for your service to our country. You know who you are, and we know who you are, and I'm not going to ask you to stand up or anything like that, but we very much appreciate what you have done. And just remember, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, Greenwich Mean Time, when the Great War we now call World War I was brought to its formal conclusion. And that war had a tremendous effect on our country. We never have been the same since that time. And we owe a deep debt of gratitude to the people who have helped our country in times like that. We come to the end of our meeting tonight, and I think every time I have a meeting here for a week, I always say on Friday that I just can't believe that it's Friday already, but I still feel that same way. I don't quite know. I try to use my time well, but I don't know how it gets by on me the way it does. It's amazing to me that it's Friday night already, and this is our last time. I have started coming up here about 50 years ago, and I've been coming back off and on ever since that time. Some people think I've been coming back more off than on. Charles came tonight especially to see me off, he said. Congratulations to Charles. He's seeing me off rather than on. Well, it's terrific of you to be with us, and I want to talk tonight about something that I think is very serious, and it concerns every one of us. One of the things that makes us human beings as opposed to animals is that we have a will. And the power of the human will is a remarkable thing. I read about, for instance, one man who is stretching his lower lip 5 inches, and he's almost done. He's been working at it for 10 years. But through the effort of the human will, he's stretching his lower lip. The little article I read failed to explain why he wanted to stretch his lower lip. I don't think he was a Ubangi tribesman or anything like that. But the point is that it's amazing what we can do if we desire to do it. Consider the yogis of India. Some are young and some are old. They sit cross-legged and motionless, staring at their noses or their navels. Some of them look directly into the face of the sun hour after hour, day after day, allowing themselves to go slowly blind. Some surround themselves with hot fires during the midday heat. Some walk barefoot on hot coals, and yes, they really do that. Some lie naked for 35 years on beds of iron spikes. Some roll their bodies thousands of miles to places of pilgrimage. Some bury themselves in the earth up to their necks and remain that way for years or even for life. Some pass a wire through both cheeks, making it impossible to open the jaws, condemning themselves to live on liquids for life. Some keep their fists clenched so long that their fingernails grow through the back of their hands. Some hold an arm or a leg out until it is withered and dead. Some sit quietly in one position, maybe for years, dulling every sense, concentrating every thought, attempting to understand. India has had these men for 2,500 years, and I mention their achievements not because I think these achievements are good. I mention these achievements simply to say that these achievements are possible. The power of the human will is a remarkable thing. The rubber band theory of human personality says that we are all stretchable to a point. There's a point past which we cannot go, but we're more stretchable than it might at first appear. I had a book called Quiet, written by Susan Cain. It's a book about introversion, and it addresses the rubber band theory of personality. You and I are like rubber bands at rest, but we're elastic and we can stretch. Only so much, it's true, but we can stretch. Free will can take us far. It cannot carry us infinitely beyond our genetic limits. I've heard young people say, oh, I could be whatever I want to be if I work hard enough. Well, that's reassuring to believe. It's not necessarily true, though. Lynn and I had a boy at our house years ago who insisted, I can play for the Kansas City Chiefs if I discipline myself enough. And discipline is good, but for something so competitive as that, you need some natural gifts as well. And there are all kinds of examples of this type of thing and what our limitations are. We're all different. As the comedian said, everybody's unique except for that one guy. And we all do have our eccentricities and our uniquenesses. I'm wondering tonight, how many of you have got a wooden leg? A wooden leg, as expressed by Eric Byrne in his book, Games People Play, many years ago. It's a book about human relationships. And he's talking about the mind games that people play in reaction to patterned and predictable transactions between each other. Transactions that conceal the real motivations and lead to well-defined, predictable outcomes, usually counterproductive. For example, one of the games in the book Games People Play was called Ain't It Awful, where you bring up any subject you want to talk about. The price of living, ain't it awful? This is a conversation you're having with somebody. The weather, ain't it awful? This weather we're having, the political situation, ain't it awful? And any subject anybody brings up, you talk about how awful it is. Another game was called Why Don't You? Yes, But, where the first person presents their own personal dilemma, and the second person says, well, why don't you do this? And the first person said, well, if I did that, then this other awful thing would happen, so I can't do that. And then the other person says, well, then why don't you do that? And the other person says, well, if I did that, then this other awful thing would happen. The second person keeps offering solution until he can't offer any more solutions because nothing would work. The goal of the game is to get the person to give up trying to help you. Why don't you? Yes, but. And they give up. If he gives up, then you've won that game. Another one of the games was called I Was Only Trying to Help, and you can imagine how that one goes. But the one I'm referring to right now was a game called Wooden Legs. Very interesting game. It uses a disability, whether real or imagined, as an excuse for not producing. And then when you're confronted for not producing, you say, well, what do you expect from somebody with a wooden leg? Now, a wooden leg could be anything that keeps you from being productive, anything that keeps you from stretching yourself, from putting yourself out there. It can be an illness, or it can be a fear. It can be bitterness or anxiety. It can be your children, or it can be your parents. It can be your boss, or the fact that you have no job. It can be your wife, or the fact that you have no wife. It can be your guilt. It can be your age. I'm too old. I'm too young. It can be your lack of education. It can be your location. It can be any inability that you can blame your lack of productivity on. Is this important? I think it is. Genesis 1:27 says that you and I are created in the image of God. And if we're made in the image of our Creator, shouldn't we be creating? Shouldn't we be creative beings? I've met people who believe that work is the result of sin. But actually, God placed man in the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it before sin. This was work given to man before sin, to bestow creative labor on the garden. Paradise on earth itself was not a place of exemption from labor. It was not a place of exemption from stretching ourselves. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air. Man was placed on earth by God to be a scientist, a researcher, a prober into the creation of God. None of us were sent into this world to be idle. He who gave us being also gave us business. And if we don't mind our business, we're unworthy of our being. Productive work was a part of man's original purpose. One of the things that made our great country successful was the work ethic of our forebears. We make a serious error if we wander through life aimlessly because God created us in His own image to fulfill a responsibility and a purpose. The question, who am I? And the question, what shall I do? are very closely and, I think, inextricably linked together. Once I learn who I am, then I cannot continue in aimless idleness. Now, here's an interesting thing. Trends in society mold our individual perspective, and they mold our way of looking at things. As a nation now, our perspective is radically different from God's people in Old Testament days. For instance, can you think of any commandment that Moses ever gave to the children of Israel to be hard workers? Did Moses ever exhort his people, now you need to get out there and work hard? I can't think of any time Moses ever said that in a command or even as a suggestion. What comes to mind is one of the Ten Commandments. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the reason that was given was not so that they would work 6 days instead of three. It was so they wouldn't work all the time. It was to keep them from working for 7 days. It was to establish the Sabbath law. Because it seems that maybe the most difficult thing for the ordinary Israelite was enforced periods of inactivity. They had a lot to do. They were farming. They also had a ceremonial law in which it was easy to pick up lots of little extra jobs. If you get ceremonially unclean, you got to take all your clothes and wash them. And yet, I can't think of any direct scolding for being lazy in the works of Moses or in the Old Testament generally, really. The Jews of ancient and modern times had and have a reputation for being industrious. Among their captives, they worked harder than the natives. They expected to work hard. When I was teaching high school, I had Jewish students who were excellent, willing workers. Maybe this helps explain, apart from greed, why they were so unwilling to give the land its rest every seventh year. Maybe they just couldn't stand that much rest themselves. Now, in the Proverbs, Solomon does tell what happens to people who don't work. He's not pronouncing curses. He's not saying you're sinning. He's just stating facts, and he's saying you're unwise. He says the sleep of the laboring man is sweet. He says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways, and be wise, in Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 11. But what I'm saying here is, some mistakes we don't make simply because we have never been in the habit of making them in the past. They're just not a part of the spectrum of our activities. Solomon points out that there were some unindustrious people in his time. In Proverbs 24, verse 30, he says, I went by the field of the slothful. So there were some non-productive people in Solomon's day. Yet a little slumber, yet a little sleep, yet a little folding of the hands to sleep. He said one time, as the door turneth upon its hinges, so the sloth turns upon his bed. But here's the thing. I don't know how a lazy man would have been treated in the law of Moses, or under that law at that time. I don't know how a lazy man would be treated. I'd like to know, but I just don't know where to find the information. Suppose in Moses' law, you had a head of household who would not work. What happened to him under the law of Moses? We know he became poor, of course. But did anybody come to his rescue? What happened to his children? There are a dozen questions we could easily ask, and I don't know the answer to these. And I'm just wondering, since work was a commonly accepted way of life among those people at that time, maybe the overwhelming majority of them never conceived the idea of not working. It seems possible to me. Now, you and I have a heritage of work, both biblically and nationally. In the early days of our country, the penalty for being caught idle was a public beating in some of the colonies. In 1900 in our country, the average man's working week was 60 hours, and that's an average. Many people worked even more than that. But now our society has 40 hours or less as a kind of a national theme, and we also have a preoccupation with recreation, vacation, retirement, etc. Maybe our attitude and our perspective toward work keeps us from stretching ourselves as we should. Maybe we get adjusted to a cycle of activity that doesn't push us too far, so that then when we read a passage like 1 Corinthians 15:58, always abounding in the work of the Lord, or a passage like 2 Corinthians 9, verse 8, abound to every good work, it's easy to play the wooden leg card. Hey, I'm just not up to this. And I've got to wonder, how will our Father feel about it when we give him that kind of an answer? How will our Father answer when we say, well, I couldn't do it because of the way I was conditioned by the way my society was? Ours has been called the age of the alibi. What are we really saying to God when we give that kind of an answer? You don't expect me to do a lot more than anybody else, do you? You don't want me to lose sleep. That's not good for me. You don't want me to strain my eyes. You don't want me to put myself out, surely. It seems that even our physical condition makes some difference to God. If I have a physical condition that I could remedy and that would make me more effective in the vineyard, am I not duty-bound to try to fix that? Might it be incumbent on me to exercise a little for the Lord? Paul said it profits a little. In Thessalonica, which was a Roman colony, there were lots of retired veterans there, and they were on the government payroll. They'd gotten used to not working. And Paul writes to that congregation in 1 Thessalonians 4:11. He tells them, study to be quiet, aspire to live quietly, aim at keeping calm, do your own business, and work with your own hands as we commanded you. There are people in this room right now who are skilled beyond belief with their hands. It's just amazing to me what some people can do with their hands. I was in one of John and Donna's rentals today. They're putting it back together after a bad renter has left. And it's amazing the skill with which they prosecute that work, the way they put things up and paint things. It's just becoming a beautiful place. Bill builds a beautiful house. It's just amazing to me. I've always been amazed by people who are this way because I'm not. But I've known people who could not even explain in words what they were doing, and yet they knew. Their hands knew. So many of you are that way. I've been in your shops, both your shops at home and your actual places of work at times through the years, and I'm always amazed all over again. Eric Severide, in his book Not So Wild a Dream about the Second World War, called this the world of the knowing hands. It was a world I could never enter personally, but some of my brethren dwell in it always, and I'm saying God bless you for that. Stretch yourself to be all that God intends you to be. Being spiritual is not only speaking to people about Christ, but it's also being the people we're supposed to be in relation to God in every way. If He gave you these skills, then you definitely should use them. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9, we see there and in other places that even the Apostle Paul, busy as he was with the gospel, even the Apostle Paul took time to make tents. Have you ever wished you could see one of Paul's tents? I've wished that so many times because I'm sure it was beautifully made. The admonitions he gave us about how to work, I'm sure he heeded himself. He says that this was his trade, and so I know he was good at it. I'm sure his tents were a wonder to behold. Now, what if you work on the job with people who do sloppy work? How should you work as a Christian? That same Paul says in Colossians 3:23, whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not to men. Heartily meaning do it out of your soul, do it with all your heart. You and I are the best workers in the country, or we ought to be. This is one of the hallmarks of the Christian faith, that it produces these kinds of people. Wherever you are, be all there. Elvis Presley had this as a life theme, TCB he called it, taking care of business. He said, if you're going to work, work. If you're going to play, play. There's a place for both, but be wholehearted in each. Down in my home congregation, which is the only place my membership has ever been there over half a century, we had a deacon there one time. His name was Charlie Mallett. He's still alive, but he's in another congregation now. But one time he made a talk at Gregory Boulevard, my home congregation, many, many years ago, and he made a statement that I've never forgotten. He said, and this is a man who is known for his work ethic and his hard work all his life. He and his son Mark did some amazing things together before his son was killed. But here's what Charlie Mallett said. If you don't have time to do the job right the first time, when are you going to have time to do it over? Yeah. When are you going to have time to do it over? We're talking about stretching ourselves tonight. Work is as natural to man as breathing. Jim Brass, my old landlord when I lived in a little trailer out in Kansas, he was in his 80s, which seemed a lot older then than it does now, believe me. But he was in his 80s at the time, and I was always amazed when he would say, I'd rather wear out than rust out. And he was an inspiration to me when I was in, I was about 20, 21 years old at that time. He's a man, 84, and getting out and working every day. I appreciated that. Thomas Edison was the man who said, there's no substitute for hard work. He said, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. And Thomas Edison was known to work 72 hours at a stretch on at least one occasion while he was hot on the tail of some invention or other. James Michener, the novelist, said, work is the principal means whereby people achieve what they want and avoid what they don't want. And he said, if I made a mistake by working too hard, at least it was a mistake in the right direction. When Alexander Campbell was asked, how do you accomplish so much? His answer was simple, by working 16 hours a day. I like the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, verse 10. This used to be one of my favorite passages, and sometimes it still is. It just depends on the day. Sometimes I have other favorite passages. But I love this one. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. That says a whole lot. That reminds me of the statement of Jesus in the New Testament, John chapter 9, verse 4. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. Whittier is the man who wrote the poem about what might have been. Of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, he said, it might have been. How often have you heard it said of somebody that it's too bad about that guy? He had the potential, he had the opportunities, his appearance was good, had a nice personality, but he just never did get himself in gear. I know people like that. It's a sad situation. They held out so much promise when they were 20, and now their life is nearly over and they're about where they were when they were 20, or maybe even a little behind that. So many of us feel that time, or the lack of time, is such an issue for us. Charles Spurgeon had an interesting illustration about that, which is kind of an exhortation as well. Here's what Charles Spurgeon said, and I'm going to quote it nearly verbatim, even though it has some old-fashioned language and old-fashioned illustrative props, but I think you'll be able to understand it. Charles Spurgeon said on the issue of time management, he said, take a large box and place in it as many cannonballs as it will hold. It's full, after a fashion, or is it? Take several bags of marbles. Many of these may be packed in the spaces between the cannonballs. And now the box is full. Yet, it will contain more. There are still spaces where you can shake down and an abundance of small shot. And now the box is filled beyond question. You can't put in another cannonball, or even another marble, or even another shot. But you will still find that several pounds of sand will slide down between the larger materials, and even then, between the granules of sand, if you'll empty your water pitcher, there will be space for all the water and several more pitchers of water as well. Where there's no space for the great, there may be room for the little. Where the little cannot enter, the less may make its way. And where the less is shut out, the least of all may find ample room. So, where time, we say, is fully occupied, there may be stray moments, there may be occasional intervals and snatches of time that may hold a vast amount of usefulness in the course of months or years. And I've known of people who took life just this way. I have actually known people who learned languages, learned complete foreign languages that they didn't know before, just in spare moments. I knew one guy that ran a lathe all day in a machine shop, but he had his little book there, and while the lathe was spinning, and he had a moment, he'd be checking out that book. He learned to speak a different language in that way. It was William F. Buckley in one of his books, it was either Cruising Speed or Overdrive, I'm not sure which, but he talked about always liking to have a book with him when he crossed a busy street in New York City, and that way if he got caught in the median for a while, he'd have something to read while he was caught out there. You know, it makes a difference. I've known people who read the whole Bible that way, just took their Bible everywhere, and this is when you only had paper Bibles. It's even easier now with your phones that many of you have the Bible on. Just take it with you everywhere, and if you're waiting in a doctor's office or anywhere you are, sometimes even at a stoplight, not while you're moving, but at a stoplight, you can just read the next little snatch of the Bible, and this builds up over time. Eventually, you've read the whole thing. We can all do this, but will we? It's what we choose. The Lord gave us an interesting illustration in the 13th chapter of the book of Luke, verses 6 through 9. It's an illustration about productivity. I think you're well familiar with it. He said, he spake this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. And he said unto the dresser of his vineyard, he said, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? And he answering said to him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I dig about it and dung it, and if it bear fruit, well, but if not, after that thou shalt cut it down. It's a lesson about productivity, that if we don't stretch ourselves, we're at risk. The God who created us knows what he gave us, and he expects some productivity. We have the same lesson in John chapter 15, verses 1 through 6. I'll not take the time to read it because you know it so well. The story of the vine and the branches. Every branch in me that doesn't bear fruit is pruned away and is not part of the vine anymore. Here's an interesting thing, I think. When Abraham Maslow created his hierarchy of needs. Now, many of you have studied Abraham Maslow in school. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the way he rated these things on the hierarchy was the length of time you can do without something is indicative of how important that thing is. For example, can you do without water longer than you can do without air? Well, yes, you can. So that sets the priority. Air, water, food. And then somewhere down the line, after the primary physical needs are met, is also the drive to create, the drive to order the chaos around you in the world. And the indication was that when man is not creating, things don't work right in his life and in his mind. In fact, in Houston a few years ago, they rated people on several attributes, manual dexterity, intellectual capacity, and areas like this, and they rated the strongest areas for these individuals, and they found out that if you were not using your strongest capabilities in some way, you were not a happy person in your life, because you needed to find an outlet for your strengths in order to be fulfilled. The need to produce something when it's blocked by external forces, or blocked by a wooden leg of our own making, means that we just don't work right and we cannot feel fulfilled. The parable of the talents in Matthew 25 is quite instructive in this regard. The five-talent man, as you all know, made an additional five talents for his master. There's a fulfillment in that. I've often thought that there must be a tremendous fulfillment in going to a blank piece of land. When you get there that first day, it's just a blank piece of land. And then when you stop going there a few months later, there's a big, new, beautiful house standing there. Some of you do that. And it must be extremely fulfilling if you're good at that type of thing. You need an outlet for that kind of creative energy. It's a tremendous thing to have that kind of creative potential. The five-talent man did well. But the one-talent man was motivated by fear. He said, I was afraid. Would that one talent man have been worse off if he had lost the talent? That's what he was afraid of. I was afraid I would lose it. Would he have been any worse off if he had tried and lost the talent? I don't think so. How could he have been worse off? Would he have been worse off if he'd just given it away? I don't think he would have been worse off if he'd stolen the thing. He didn't produce. He couldn't have been worse off according to the way the story is told. I'm afraid that many of us do nothing about fear except just suffer it, when what we need to do is the very thing that we're afraid of. The very best way to get past your knee-knocking, cold-chilling, tongue-tying fright is to do the thing you're afraid to do. Stretch yourself. Get out there and accomplish something. You know, the first time, John was talking the other night about unusual gifts and these types of things. I think some of us decided that the unusual gifts I have are things that people give to me that I don't always know what to do with. They're unusual gifts. But the first time I was supposed to make a public speech, and it came time, they announced me to go up front. I didn't know whether to go up front and make a speech or go downstairs and vomit. It could have gone either way. As it turned out, I figured it would be less embarrassing to go make the speech, so I did that. And I learned then, as so often I have had reinforced in life, so many times the anticipation of a thing is worse than the actual event. If we just push ourselves on through it, we learn that we can do it, it wasn't so bad after all. Winston Churchill, in his later years, had always wanted to paint all his life, but he'd never taken time for it. He'd been a busy guy. A couple World Wars and so forth. Anyway, he decided to try painting. So he got a canvas, got a bunch of paints and brushes, and he's sitting out in the yard with this canvas, totally white canvas in front of him. He's sitting there looking at it, and he can't begin. Doesn't have any clue where to begin. So his neighbor, her name was Hazel Waver, she sees him sitting out there. She comes over, she takes one of his brushes, she smears a little paint on the canvas, and then she hands the brush to Winston and says, "Now you're started. It's not perfect anymore, so now you can paint." And he became a very interesting painter. People learn to do things. Why sit and wish? Some of you know the McClung family down around the Excelsior Springs area. I want to use one of them as an example, and I hope it's okay to do this. He's welcome to tell me if it isn't, but his name is Darren McClung. He's out of the church now, I hope temporarily, but I want to use him as an illustration because I want you to picture this. He was 17 years old. He was legally blind because of an affliction that was no fault of his own. Legally blind, he could just barely distinguish between light and dark. But he was still participating in the church. When he got up to make a reading in the church, he would have to put his nose right up to the page like this to be able to see the words, and he'd have to turn his head sideways so the microphone could pick up what he was saying. He led songs the same way, with the book like this, as he led the congregation in song. That young man was so inspiring. He inspired me to tears, literally. And you can quote me on that. Like I say, he's out of the church now, and I hope that he will be back in someday. But he was stretching himself. Anybody would have said to him, "Oh, you don't have to do that. You don't, you know." Nobody would have pressed him on it. But he was out there stretching himself. The question is, what would you do to rise above? What would you do to overcome a handicap? You know you can. Therefore, you must. It's been my observation that people who have real wooden legs are often more productive than those of us who have false wooden legs. I read about a guy not long ago in a wheelchair. He plunged into a swimming pool out of his wheelchair to save a child that was drowning in that pool. It seems that those of us who are whole are often afraid of losing something. But the people with the real wooden legs have already lost a lot, and they still see that life is good. They don't want to lose any more than they've already lost through self-pity or fear or bitterness. Sometimes we who are whole give up more than they have already lost because of our wooden legs. I think we must, in some cases, be tragic figures in their eyes. Here they are, disabled and in many cases productive and happy, and we are whole and sometimes unproductive and unhappy. When your wooden leg starts to act up, just throw it away and stretch yourself. It may change your life. And that's important because we are today exactly where our thinking has brought us. And tomorrow we're going to be where our thinking takes us. And if we want to be someplace different tomorrow than we are today, we're going to have to change our thinking. We need to come to the point of spiritual puberty and ask ourselves, who am I in the family of God? We need to evaluate our lives individually. Evaluate your life with its weaknesses and strength. Examine your life. What are your weaknesses? Temper? Indecision, depression, procrastination. Not too long ago, a guy recommended to me what he said is a real good book about procrastination, but so far I haven't gotten around to reading it. But I want to. Understand your weaknesses to keep them from defeating you. Assess your gifts and abilities. What gifts has God given you that you can use to advance His kingdom? Examine yourself honestly. Did He give you artistry? Did He give you mechanics? These are gifts from God. Not everybody can develop these. When we underestimate our abilities, we reflect against the giver. When we say, "Oh, I can't do that," when we really can, that's not only a lie, but we're saying that God didn't give us what He really did give us. Nobody in the parable of the talents got none. The least God ever gave was one. His goods have been delivered unto you. What has He given you? 1 Corinthians 10 teaches us that just because we've been delivered is no sign we've reached our destination. Those Israelites were delivered from Egyptian bondage, but that first generation never even reached the promised land. They left their bones to bleach in the desert because they didn't follow God in faith. And verse 6 of that chapter, 1 Corinthians 10, says that these things were our examples. And verse 11 of that chapter indicates again that these things happened as our example. Paul doesn't want us to miss that point. You and I now are living in the last age of the world, the Christian era, the third era of time. There won't be a fourth while we're here on this earth. Things that happened to previous people were written for our benefit. Examine yourself with a sense of individual personal responsibility. Whatever your gifts are, they can help the body of Christ. Become discontent with your present status. Are you happy with yourself tonight? I'm not satisfied with myself, and I'm trying to make changes to do better and be better. You'll never change as long as you're self-satisfied. Resolve to improve with God's help. Be resolute. This affects every phase of life. Resolve to be different. Pray regularly for divine assistance. You know, I find the older I get, the more I pray. And the more when I'm by myself in my office, I'll just actually literally go to my knees to God and talk to Him. Seems like I didn't used to do that near as much, but I have a sense of need in that area more now than I ever have before. Also, study God's Word systematically. Study it consistently. It's not just a matter of reading it through from one end to the other. Take an individual book. Figure out who wrote it, why they wrote it, who they were writing to, what the main point is. For each of the 66 books, the Bible's big, but it's not that big. We can conquer this. We can each have a good working knowledge of the Word of God. It's imperative that we do this. It's high time that we do it. Consecrate yourself to the task. Dedicate yourself. Think of what the world can receive from you. It's important that we each individually think through this, because the body of Christ as a unit does not think. Only individuals think. Only an individual can say, "Here am I, Lord, send me." Embrace every opportunity to function. Learn by doing. What is it that you're afraid of? Are you afraid to meet people? Afraid to talk to them? Just force yourself to do it. I was flabbergasted one time. I think my jaw hit the ground when Wilford Landis was teaching a public class, and he said that he was shy to meet people. Can you believe that? So those of you who knew Wilford Landis, could you believe that he was shy to meet people? But he claimed that he was. How did he do it then? Well, he just forced himself to do it. That was what he claimed. I don't think he was lying. But you'd have never known it by watching him in action. He was always the first to go up with his hand extended out. That's an important lesson, I think. Whatever it is that you need to overcome, just drive yourself, prod yourself, kick yourself, stretch yourself. It's the only way. Translate knowledge into action, because knowledge not acted on is useless. Let's say you go to the doctor and the doctor writes you a prescription. So you go to the pharmacist and the pharmacist fills your prescription. He prints on the bottle, "Take one tablet after every meal and another one at bedtime." And you go home, you put that bottle on the table. And after every meal, you pick that up and you read it. Take one tablet after every meal and another one at bedtime. Then you put it back down on the table. Before long, you can quote it. You don't even have to pick it up and read it anymore. You can quote it by heart. Take one tablet after every meal and another one at bedtime. But it doesn't help you even a little bit, because you didn't digest it. You didn't actually take the pill. You just read the prescription. Reading the prescription doesn't help you. It's taking the medicine. You can memorize the prescription to no avail. Each one of us needs to think of ourselves as a participant, not as a spectator. This is no basketball game, and we're not fans, and we're not cheerleaders. We are soldiers in an army, and this is no game, and the night is far spent, and the day is at hand. Be involved in the life of God's family. People often leave because they're not involved. You ever watch a child who's watching other kids play a game, but he's not involved? He's either going to get involved, or pretty soon he'll wander away. God calls us to involvement, and involvement means fulfillment. And the only way you can fulfill the function that God has in mind for you is to do what He has equipped you to do. Only you can fulfill this function, and it's up to you to decide whether you're going to do that or not. The lesson of the parable of the laborers in the vineyard in Matthew 20 is that idleness is for the marketplace. Every person in the marketplace was sent into the vineyard. Doesn't matter how old you are when you're sent into the vineyard. The important thing is to come when you're called. What's past is prologue. We start now. This is the first day that you can do anything about. You can do nothing about the past. Doesn't matter how old you are. Just come when you're called. That parable teaches us that when we come to the vineyard, we are regarded as laborers. We are servants. We are ministers of God. Once in a while somebody asks me, "Rick, when did you enter the ministry?" Well, I entered the ministry the day I came up out of the waters of baptism, and so did you. I hope you knew that, and I think most of you did. When you come up out of the water of baptism, you are in Christ and you're entering the ministry at that point. I don't care if you're 13 years old. If you're in Christ, you are a minister of God. And no man ordains you to be a minister. Only God ordains His ministers. You can take a minister of God and ordain him to be a bishop. You can take a minister of God and ordain him to be a deacon. You can take a minister of God and ordain him to be an evangelist. But nobody can ordain you to be a minister of God. Only God ordains his ministers. He doesn't invite sightseers into his vineyard. He wants laborers. And only you can fulfill the function God has for you. No one else can take your place. That's a difficult thing to believe at first, but once you believe it, it's a difficult thing to bear because it's such a responsibility. No one else can take your place. We have to lose our lives to really find them. We have a choice between discipline and decadence, and the difference is habit, and habit is character. Too often, we use these wonderful minds God gave us only for the purpose of devising excuses for doing what the heart wanted to do in the first place. But the disciplined character has the ability to subordinate the lesser to the greater. The disciplined character looks at the problem of priorities with great seriousness, because the problem of priorities is probably the most crucial problem we face in the Christian life. It's on the way we handle the issue of priorities that success or failure hangs. Success or failure hangs there, improvement or degeneration hangs there, and ultimately, heaven or hell hangs what we do with the issue of priorities. This battle is not primarily to achieve a clear perception of what is most important. We've all read the prescription, and we know what the prescription says. The issue is, are we taking the medicine so we can digest it? We all acknowledge that God should hold first place in our lives. We all acknowledge that people should come before things. We all acknowledge that usefulness is better than idleness. The problem is not knowledge. The problem is actually giving first place to those things in daily living. And part of stretching ourselves involves rejecting day by day the great army of possible activities which clamor for our precious time and energy, but which would hamper the doing of more important things. If life's going to be fruitful, if life's going to be purposeful, we must decisively put the knife to most of the possible activities which could clutter every single day. Some of you are in real estate. If the key to real estate is location, 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 then surely the key to living is selection, selection, selection. We just can't join everything. We just can't participate in every good cause. We can't give to everything. We can't go to every interesting concert or lecture or meeting or game. We can't read everything. Therefore, we must select. George Washington Carver was a very interesting man. Began life as a slave down in the southern part of Missouri. They've got a little area now that is devoted to educating people about him down there, some several miles south of Joplin in Missouri. He was a great scientist. He was the one that found so many uses for the peanut, you know. Great scientist. And one time he called on Andrew Carnegie. I'm not ever clear on whether it's Carnegie or Carnegie. Used to be Carnegie always, but then people started saying Carnegie. But you know who I'm talking about. The great industrialist and philanthropist. The man who spent the first half of his life making mountains of money and then the last half of his life giving it away. Anyway, George Washington Carver called on Andrew Carnegie, making an appeal on behalf of an experiment that he was involved in. And Carnegie was willing, and he wrote Mr. Carver a check. Carver looked at the check. It wasn't for as much as he had expected to receive from this very wealthy man. George Washington Carver said to Andrew Carnegie very simply, "Sir, I have not impressed you with the greatness of my cause." When you and I are impressed with the greatness of the cause of Christ, then we will no longer have a first-rate dedication to second-rate causes. The rich man in the Lord's parable said to himself, "Soul, take thine ease." And in fairness to the rich man, that may have been the first time he planned to take his ease in his life. He may never have taken his ease before. Maybe he hated indolence. Maybe he hated self-indulgence before. Maybe he had practiced hard work and frugality and industry and early rising and long days. But whatever he had been, he had first-rate dedication to a second-rate cause, and God called him a fool. Maybe he had discipline without holiness. The finest discipline is seen when it's connected with holiness. And it's seen not in rigidity, but in resiliency. If you get interrupted, go back to the task. Complete what is begun. Other duties may interrupt, but force yourself to go back. Cultivate an attitude of sincere gratitude for all correction that comes your way. Now that's difficult. It's difficult to be grateful for a correction, especially when we question the other person's qualifications to instruct us or correct us, or especially when we don't agree with them, when we don't think they're right. But I say just accept it and consider it and let it help if it can. It's not going to hurt you if you consider it and reject it. At least you gave it a shot in your mind. You do not have any right to be mediocre if God has made you capable of something better. The main difficulty in stretching yourself is conquering yourself. Too many of us Americans are like spoiled children who must have immediately satisfaction for all of our urges, and life becomes a pattern of cheating the calendar and seizing privileges and pleasures before we're entitled to them. And we become almost unable to accept delay. But the Bible says, wait. Just as Longfellow said in his famous Psalm of Life, at the end of it, learn to labor and to wait. Play should be the occasional restorative, not the perpetual pursuit of life. And when life does not buffet us, we may need to buffet ourselves to stretch ourselves. Knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believe. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Awake thou that sleepest, and rise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee life. Walk circumspectly, looking around you. Present your body a living sacrifice. And you can't present your body to God without presenting what your body can do. Every talent you have, if you're in Christ, becomes the property of the church. As fellow heirs, you have a right to expect me to use my talent to assist you in getting your work done. Because I don't belong to myself. All that I can do and all that I can learn to do becomes the corporate property of the body of Christ. Jesus loved us enough to die for us. We love him enough to live for him. So we've got a personal responsibility. And remember this, well done, thou good and faithful servant. It is not going to be said to those who didn't and who weren't. The Lord is not going to lie about it. He won't say, well done, good and faithful, if we haven't been faithful and if we haven't done well. And we're not going to get out of this earth alive. And we're not going to avoid the scrutiny of God. A lot of people fear an audit from the IRS, like that's the worst thing that could happen. But we're all going to be audited in the end by the God who sees through everything. All the cards are going to be on the table, no exit in any direction. All things naked and open under the eyes of him with whom we have to do. A righteous judge who knows all. We need to seriously consider stretching ourselves to be more nearly what God has equipped us to be. It's been such a pleasure to be with you this week. I deeply appreciate your, not only your attendance, but your fine, at least apparent concentration on what we've been talking about night by night. I've been watching you closely. I know who's doing what more than you might think. You're quite entertaining. But I really do appreciate you all being with us and hanging with us through all of this. And we're going to conclude one more time by extending the Lord's invitation, because we never know the hearts of those who are present. It may be that this is the time for someone who's here tonight to obey the Lord in primary obedience. Or if you have anything else to bring before the brethren, let us know how we can assist you in any way by coming to the front as we stand together and sing one more song.